Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I am John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, November 4th, 2016. Amnesty International is calling on South Sudanese authorities to release James Gadet.
He's already in South Sudan. His deportation was a violation of international law, and to correct that wrong, it would require returning him to Kenya. It's difficult to imagine the South Sudanese authorities doing this voluntarily.
And Juba is asking Kenyan authorities to not to pull from South Sudan.
We pleaded with the Kenyan government not to implement its decision. At the same time, we pleaded or requested the UN Security Council to sit with the Kenyan government and so that they can come up with an amicable solution.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Amnesty International says the deportation of the spokesman for Riek Machar is a dangerous attack on refugee rights. Amnesty International's Deputy Director for East Africa, the Horn and the Great Lakes says James Gadet's deportation is an attack on refugees' rights to safety, and it places Gadet at a grave risk of torture and other ill treatment. Elizabeth Deng is Amnesty International researcher for Sudan and South Sudan. She says Gadet could face torture at the hands of South Sudanese authorities.
We do know that he was, in fact, deported from Kenya yesterday on Thursday, November 3rd, that he arrived in Juba, and according to STLM-IO, he's now in custody of the National Security Service. That's not something we've been able to independently confirm.
We understand that Gadet got refugee status in Kenya in 2005. Is it common for a country to deport refugees?
Under international law, Kenya has an obligation to protect refugees. That includes respecting the fundamental principle of non-refoulement, meaning that Kenya should not force refugees to return to the places that they fled from or where their lives or freedoms could be threatened. So certainly this deportation appears to be, you know, a clear violation of this principle of non-refoulement.
And in a situation where someone like Gadet is deported from here to South Sudan, what are the things that he will go through in the hands of the South Sudanese authorities?
Gadet is a well-known member of the SPLM-IO and, you know, is still allied with Riek Machar, who fled the country after being pursued by the government out of Juba. We have documented numerous cases of long-term arbitrary detention, torture, and other ill treatment by South Sudan's National Security Service and military intelligence against individuals perceived as having some affiliation with SPLM-IO. So certainly, given Gadet's position within the IO and the fact that he's, you know, very well known and very vocal as spokesperson, we do believe that there is a high risk that he would be subjected to similar or, if not worse, treatment, including long-term detention, torture, and other ill treatment.
I know that Amnesty International does not speak for UNHCR or refugee agencies, but do you know if the UNHCR office in Nairobi tried to prevent Gadet from being deported?
Yes. The information we have is that the UNHCR sent lawyers to the airport to try and intervene. These lawyers were refused access to Gadet by Kenyan police and immigration officials. We also, you know, have been told that UNHCR was reaching out to the Kenyan authorities during, you know, following his arrest and prior to his deportation.
Now that he's in Juba, is there any way the international community could help secure his release?
We would like to see international pressure on the government of South Sudan to release him and to grant him access to UNHCR officials in South Sudan so that he can return to Kenya.
South Sudanese authorities would say he's their national and he's no longer a refugee in South Sudan. How would that work?
You know, I mean, it's unfortunate that He's already in South Sudan. His deportation was a violation of international law, and to correct that wrong, it would require returning him to Kenya. It's difficult to imagine the South Sudanese authorities doing this voluntarily, but, I mean, that is what we're certainly calling for.
That's Elizabeth Deng, Amnesty International researcher for Sudan and South Sudan. She was speaking to me from Nairobi. South Sudan in Focus made repeated calls to UNHCR spokesman Marco Lembo for comments, but he did not pick our several calls. SPLM-IO leader Riek Machar issued a statement today condemning Gadet's deportation. Machar said Kenya's move to deport his spokesman violates the UN Geneva Convention. Machar gave orders to his forces to protect Kenyans who are working in areas under the control of the SPLM-IO. The South Sudan government says it is pleading with Kenya to not to implement its decision to withdraw its peacekeepers from the UN mission in South Sudan after the UN Secretary General fired on Ms. Commander from Kenya following the release of an independent probe into the violence in Juba. Tito Justin reports for VOA from Juba.
In its 18th Council of Ministers meeting, government spokesperson Michael McQuay told reporters that Kenya's decision to withdraw its peacekeepers from South Sudan will affect the agreement on the resolution of conflict in South Sudan.
If the Kenyan government insists on its decision, then definitely we will have to review the whole process, because there are already forces here which are Kenyan, and Kenya is supposed also to contribute forces to the RPF. And if it has decided to withdraw its forces and not to contribute, then definitely that is a setback also.
McQuay says if Kenya withdraws, the government will have to revive its decision to accept the deployment of the Regional Foreign Protection Force. McQuay is urging the United Nations mission in South Sudan and the government of Kenya to sit down and discuss their differences in order to help the government achieve peace in South Sudan.
We pleaded with the Kenyan government not to implement its decision. At the same time, we pleaded or requested the UN Security Council to sit with the Kenyan government and so that they can come up with an amicable solution for the interest of peace in South Sudan, because we are the people affected most, not the UN, not the Kenyan government.
Kenya announced it would pull its peacekeepers out of South Sudan a day after UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon fired Lieutenant General Johnson Kimami Odhiaki, the Kenyan Army's force commander, earlier this week. Kenya also said it would no longer contribute troops to a regional protection force to be dispatched to South Sudan and will disengage from the peace process. For VOA News, I am Tito Justin in Juba.
Sudan's Minister of Finance and Economic Planning announced new economic measures last night that will increase the prices of diesel and petrol. The new measures also raise electricity prices for citizens around the country. The government says the new move are needed to stabilize the worsening economy. For VOA News, Nabil Biagio has more from Khartoum.
Sudan's petroleum minister, Mahmoud Zayed Awad, says all petrol stations in the country have been given the new prices. Speaking in Arabic, he says they are all part of a package of economic reforms the government is undertaking.
Petrol and gasoline have been included in the increase of prices, and all companies and distribution outlets have been informed and are using the new pricing we provided.
The prices of gasoline and benzene jumped 30%. This morning, a gallon of diesel increased by 5 Sudanese pounds, selling for 18 pounds instead of 13, while petrol increased by 7 pounds, selling at 28 pounds instead of 21. Speaking in Arabic, Finance Minister Badruddin Mahmoud says the government will enact measures to ensure that poor people are not hit too hard by the increases.
We will continue subsidizing electricity for poor people whose monthly consumption is less than 400 kilowatt, and we will allocate money to help poor people afford medicines.
Mahmoud also says there will be a 20% rise in salaries and allowances for civil servants. Political analyst Ismail Ibrahim calls the government promises empty talk. He says many people are going to suffer under the new economic measures.
It will hit very hardly the most vulnerable sectors of the society, and particularly the poor people and the fixed low-income group. Those who have already been suffering, and now they are going to suffer more.
Ibrahim says healthcare may become out of reach for millions of citizens as a result of the government's new policies.
When they liberalize or lift up the subsidy on the medicines and the medical equipment, so automatically their prices will be doubling. It will be unbearable, you know, and unaffordable to those vulnerable sectors of the society.
Haj Hamad, another Khartoum-based analyst, says the government is taking these measures because it is already spending too much on its military and security operations in war-torn Darfur, South Kordofan, and Blue Nile states.
This is 70% of the annual budget. And inside it, 70% goes to salaries and dues for individuals.
Hamad says, instead of putting more strain on the citizens by raising prices of diesel and petrol, the government needs to restore peace across the country and allocate more of its budget to funding social services, including healthcare and education. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, UN aid agencies warn the humanitarian crisis in South Sudan is going from bad to worse. Find out when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
which of your parents do you take after and why?
I think I take after both of my parents, but more dominantly is my mom because I've spent more years living with her than my dad.
It's my mom. She's hardworking and she has been a very good example. I think I can even stand out to be a good wife because my mom has been a very good example to me.
Since my dad is my motivator, I take him more than my mom, though she's also there. So I take my dad more because, anyway, I should say he's approachable.
I take after my mom because I've lived mostly with her.
I take after my mom a lot because my dad wasn't around much. I have traits in the way she behaves.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. UN agencies warn the humanitarian crisis in South Sudan is getting worse as famine looms and growing numbers of refugees flee to neighboring countries. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The World Food Programme reports a 38-truck convoy carrying food for about 1 month arrived in the South Sudanese town of Yei on Friday. The agency says the food and other relief supplies will be a lifesaver for thousands of families who have been trapped in the area for 4 months because of fighting and insecurity. WFP spokeswoman Bettina Lucia says thousands of people in Yei and throughout South Sudan are fleeing intensified violence that stems from the country's nearly three-year conflict. She says they have been forced to leave their crops to rot in the field, adding to a growing problem of hunger.
Up to 4 million people, a third of the population in South Sudan, are severely food insecure, meaning a third of the country doesn't know where the next meal is coming from. The malnutrition is above emergency levels in 7 of the 10 states, nearly twice of the emergency threshold in 2 states. We are very concerned that the threat of famine is very real, that it could happen.
Lucia says humanitarian agencies have helped to stave off catastrophes so far, but she says funds to carry out life-saving operations are running out. She says WFP urgently needs $113 million for operations through January. In the meantime, the United Nations Refugee Agency reports the number of people fleeing South Sudan continues to grow. Last month, it says an average of 3,500 people fled to neighboring countries each day. UNHCR spokeswoman Cecile Puyi says 9 out of 10 refugees are women and children, with most of the outflow, around 2,400 per day, arriving in Uganda.
Most of the arrivals are from equatorial regions, and they report armed groups harassing civilians, killings, torturing people suspected of supporting opposition factions, burning villages, and sexually abusing women and girls.
In recent weeks, says Puyi, refugees have increasingly used informal border crossing points, reportedly because armed groups are preventing them from using main roads. She says many have been forced to walk through the bush for days without food or water. The UNHCR says it is scaling up its operations in Uganda and in the other countries of asylum, Ethiopia, Sudan, and the Democratic Republic of Congo, to keep pace with the growing refugee exodus from South Sudan. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Some young South Sudanese refugee students say they are determined to get an education and improve their lives despite the hardship they face on a daily basis. Today, hundreds of young South Sudanese refugees in Uganda sat for their primary leaving examination in various schools. Mungumedev Srakarinj visited one of the schools and has this report for VOA from Uganda's Adjumani district.
All together, pen friends!
Pen friends!
Pen friends!
Pen friends!
Mariam!
Mariam!
I have a letter.
Teacher Drusil Funyisa takes students of primary 5 class through an English lesson at Nyumazu Primary School in Nyumazu Refugee Settlement. The pupils here, who are mostly South Sudanese, hope they will successfully complete the examinations and join secondary school. 17-year-old Gabriel Major says he fled his native Jonglei state when fighting broke out in December 2013. Together with his parents, the young man ran to the bush for safety, spending days without food. Gabriel says the family walked dozens of kilometers and eventually made their way to Uganda through Juba. Gabriel says he faces many challenges, including a lack of money to buy exercise books. He says sometimes he has to go an entire day without a meal. Despite those challenges, Gabriel spent time preparing for this week's final examinations. Gabriel says young people like him must get an education so they can participate in developing their country when peace returns.
I expect to be a teacher in future because I've seen teaching, to be a teacher is also a good thing. You acquire knowledge. So I expect to be a teacher in future. When we go back to our country, I will also bring them up like how I was brought up, and I teach them also.
Gabriel's classmate, 16-year-old Yar Susan Garang, says she's optimistic she and other refugee students here will pass the examinations despite their hardships.
Lack of books sometimes is a problem, but I've now handled it because when a friend has a book, you go and borrow from him because these guys here are all kind. So when you ask for a book, they give you and then you use it.
Susan says she wants to be a doctor. 16-year-old Deng Ayen, another pupil at the same school, says he too is hopeful the refugees will succeed in their education.
That is what it is in our mind, because no one come to school to fail, so we come to pass. Also, people come to school so that they can learn and become better people in future. In future, I want to be an engineer.
Abuni Samuel teaches the South Sudanese. He says he sympathizes with the students and the challenges facing them.
Though they are candidates, they do sleep at least 3 or 4 in a room whereby they cannot revise properly, and it gives them difficulties. They may only have a time to read in a school here. And then we are teaching them in 2 classrooms where there are over 70 there. So class management has become very difficult. Then even to check their work, sometimes we may not be through with all of them because of their great numbers. So assessing them is also something which is difficult.
Samuel says there are 1,040 students at Nyumazi Primary School in Nyumazi Refugee Settlement. 80% of the population of pupils studying at the school are South Sudanese. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Ruakarinj, reporting from Nyumazi Refugee Settlement, Northern Uganda.
Still in Uganda, the UN World Food Programme says a recent study indicates that giving sanctuary to refugees has enormous benefits for Uganda's economy. Uganda hosts 800,000 refugees from countries around the region, including South Sudan, Sudan, Democratic Republic of Congo, Rwanda, Burundi, Somalia, and Kenya. Simon Peter Apiku reports for VOA from the Ugandan capital, Kampala.
International humanitarian agencies have praised what they say is Uganda's progressive refugee policy, and WFP says the policy is paying off. The University of California, Davis, in partnership with the WFP, conducted a study on the economic impacts of Uganda's refugee policy. Researchers say it's the first time economic value has been derived from giving refugees humanitarian assistance or cash and land for agricultural production. Yako Vali is a program officer with the WFP who helped conduct the research.
When you give some cash for, in this case, a refugee household, they go to the local markets and purchase some goods over there, in this case mostly food, but the money doesn't remain in the markets. It goes into a pocket of a trader, and again it doesn't stay with the trader. The trader will spend it into something and will purchase again some goods or services, and then it goes to another provider or retailer or producer, and so forth. It starts spreading and stimulating the local economy.
For years, the WFP's assistance to refugees in Uganda was largely in the form of food items. In 2014, the agency began an experiment that offered refugees who had spent more than a year in the settlements the option to choose between cash and food. Vali says the study shows providing a combination of cash, food, and agricultural land had a huge impact on the local economy.
When Dalif Peace gives cash to refugees and the government gives land to the refugees, one single refugee household is able to generate out of this assistance more than $1,000 annually, which will spill into the local economy. There are also spillover effects with the in-kind food, but it's slightly less, around $800 every year.
Vali says it's a win-win situation for the government and refugees.
Each dollar what WFP gives to refugees generates an additional $1 up to $1.50 in the local economy when goods and services are traded, people are employed, more goods are brought in order to satisfy the demand, which is driven up with the cash assistance.
Vali says the research examined data on production activities in and around refugee settlements, expenditure patterns and income, which helped generate an economic model that led to the new findings. The WFP assists some 700,000 refugees across the country, including 100,000 who receive cash. WFP says it hopes to double the number of refugees on cash assistance by March. For VOA News, I am Simon Peter Apiku in Kampala, Uganda.
South Sudanese women are developing interest in some male-dominated skills, including carpentry. Local workshop in Imatong State Capital, Torit, has enrolled six women who say they want to prove women can do what men can do. Dimo Silva Aurelio visited the workshop and reports for VOA from Torit.
Wilson Sons and Friends is a local workshop at Omoliha Market in Torit. Women dressed in overalls are making furniture and displaying samples of their work, including chairs, tables, and beds. Speaking in Arabic, Margaret Juma, a mother of four, say her husband has been very supportive since he joined the training.
We came here to learn so that we can be able to make our own, because we don't have any work here. After completing this training and I am given the tools, I will be able to put a workshop at home.
Ipula Arasho, a mother of eight, has never been at a school. Speaking in her Oruho native language, Ipula says the training she is receiving here will allow her to contribute to her community.
We have made chairs, and after we complete, we want to go and improve our villages so that people will say our people got training in carpentry and are doing the work for the first time in the village. Some of us come from Tirangore, Iloli, and Lodo, and people will be saying this is the first time we are seeing women doing carpentry.
Knight Michael is another female carpentry trainee. He's speaking in Arabic. She says women can do carpentry work.
When I started this work, people, including my neighbors, were surprised if I tell them I work as a carpenter. They laughed, but I told them I am determined and I will see if it is impossible. When I work with my overall, people, especially men, could say, when have women become carpenters?
Some men, like Solomon Lado, believe that carpentry should be done by men, not women. He says women are incapable of such tasks.
The work carpentry is very hard work. A woman cannot manage to do that. That is why, because it needs force. Now, a woman is really very weak, cannot manage to do that job. So that is why it's fit for men to do that. But for women, they need light industry.
Sebi Simon agrees with Lado. Is speaking in Arabic, he says he welcomes the challenge brought forward by six women trying to change that kind of opinion.
People here were not allowing women do this work, and if they see woman doing such work for man is bad, but everybody supposed to do. For us here, it has not happened that women do carpentry, but women can also do it well.
Juma Rhino is the director of Wilson Sons and Friends Workshop. He's speaking in Arabic. He says that the women being trained in his workshop are actually performing well.
I want to encourage all the women to join this industry as their fellow women are now doing, so that they can be able to sustain their homes and not beg. With this work, they can get profit and furnish their homes through the business of carpentry.
The initiative to engage women in the carpentry came from Solidarity Association for Rehabilitation and Recovery Affairs, a local organization in Turid. The women will be given carpentry tools to start their own businesses at home or take up carpentry jobs around the country. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Turid.
That's our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song Nadoki by Jimmy Bob.
Ngado kidugu merisa ya kwana Jomo Mercedes lofo nijene Nuololo Nadoki Nadoki ya wade malita muze Nadoki 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 ya wade malita yaba Nadoki Nadoki, Nadoki ya wakitenko tore. Nadoki, Nadoki, Nadoki ya wade malita muze. Nadoki dugu merisa ya kwana. Jama Mercedes lofo nijene. Wololo, Nadoki. Nadoki ya wade malita yaba Nadoki, Nadoki Nadoki ya wade malita muze Nadoki, Nadoki Nadoki ya wakitenko tore Nadoki, Nadoki Nadoki ya wade malita muze
We've been listening to Jimmy Bop with the song Nadoki. I'm John Tanza in Washington. You have a peaceful weekend and join us again next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Nadoki, 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 awade malita yaba, Nadoki.